Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Corporations have huge influence in our government, which they use to gain tax breaks, government subsidies, and policies that favor their companies. Corporate influence distorts every area of government, from energy to the food we eat and the air we breathe. How can we stop the growing power of corporations? Will the left and right join together and take back our government for we the people? Here to address this vital issue is Ralph Nader, the nation's leading consumer crusader and public defender. Mr. Nader first made headlines in 1965 with his book, Unsafe at Any Speed, a scathing indictment of the auto industry for producing unsafe vehicles that led to the passage of auto safety laws. Nader went on to champion major federal consumer protection laws, from motor vehicle safety to the Safe Drinking Water Act, and help launch federal agencies such as OSHA and the Environmental Protection Agency. Ralph Nader has founded numerous organizations such as Public Citizen and inspired legions of consumer advocates, citizen activists, and public interest lawyers who in turn have established their own organizations throughout the country. His national network of citizen groups have had a major impact in areas ranging from tax reform to nuclear energy to health and safety. Nader has dedicated his life to empowering people to create a government responsive to citizens' needs so we can have a better society. Today, Nader focuses on the growing power of multinational corporations and the dangerous convergence of corporate and government power. His most recent book is Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. Ralph Nader, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you very much.
Your recent book, Unstoppable, I think is your best work yet, and it examines the possibility of a left-right alliance to take on the corporate state. How would you summarize the core argument of your book?
Well, the argument is that left-right sense that corporations are dominating our entire political economy in ways that spell dictatorial power and over-commercialization of our cultural and spiritual life. So what we're seeing here is a common recognition by left-right that government has been turned into a guarantor of corporate misbehavior and speculation, such as Wall Street, a guarantor. And that comes from corporations swarming over Washington, putting their people in top government positions, funding all kinds of candidates or incumbents, and turning Washington into a servant of Wall Street, otherwise known as the corporate state. The left calls it corporate welfare, and the right calls it crony capitalism. Under that umbrella of convergence between left and right are a lot of issues, some quite surprising. For example, operationally now, there is a left-right convergence behind restoring the minimum wage, at least to what it was in 1968, adjusted for inflation, which would take it from a federal level of $7.25 to $10.92 now. There may be quibbling around the edges, but when you come in 70-80% in the polls supporting a restored minimum wage, that includes a lot of conservative workers in Walmart and elsewhere. But on other issues, there's a convergence. There's a growing convergence against what I call bailout capitalism. That is, if you're too big, then you're too big to fail. Then you collapse on the back of the taxpayers who bail you out, the very people who are the workers and consumers and investors who have been gouged, fleeced, and shattered by your speculation in the first place. There's also a growing left-right against empire and foreign wars of aggression that are boomeranging on us. And that partly is because the right sees it as a huge waste of taxpayer money and unconstitutionally non-authorized. You know, it's they're constitutionally compliant people. They think that only Congress can declare war, and that's what's in the Constitution, not the president. And on the left, it's the repression of people around the world, civilians, people who want to challenge their own dictatorships that are propped up by U.S. military and diplomatic and economic cover. So those are three big areas, but there are a lot of other areas as well. I think Patriot Act is coming up for renewal next year. And in the prior two times when this anti-civil libertarian law that came out of the panic after 9/11 with no hearings pushed through by Bush and Cheney, the renewal in the two prior times were just rubber stamps. They didn't even have a discussion in the Senate and the House worthy of the name. Now I think maybe there'll be some opposition to renewing some of its provisions, such as snooping on your library borrowings or being able to sneak and peek, that is, search your home and not tell you for 72 hours. We can see left-right converging at the state level on juvenile justice reform, on the war on drugs. We see it at the state level successfully in juvenile justice. 15 states have already passed it. That couldn't have happened without conservative and liberal legislators. And after the Supreme Court decision on eminent domain that said New London could take an entire neighborhood and give it to Pfizer, about 24 states passed laws saying not in these states. You're not going to take private property and give it to corporate property. Taking private properties only for public uses like roads and bridges and tunnels and schools, etc. So that's the thrust of my book, Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Coalition Alliance, rather, to dismantle the corporate state. It's important. It's not just a coalition to achieve anything. It's to dismantle the corporate state and its takeover of our government, a lot of our culture, the commercialization of childhood with bad stuff being sold, little kids undermining and bypassing parental authority. That's a big one, too. So I think it's already out there in the minds of people who call themselves conservatives and liberals. The challenge is to turn it operational. Some of it is already operational. We won the Whistleblower Protection Act last year against corporate lobbyists, giving federal employees rights to blow the whistle on corporate fraud on government programs like Medicare and military contracts. Some of it is just beginning to congeal, beginning to get media attention, like the juvenile justice issues. And some of it is still in the minds of tens of millions of conservative, liberal, Republican, Democrat Americans. It hasn't yet gone operational. But I have a chapter on how to fund it. I have a chapter not sugarcoating the whole issue, taking one obstacle after another, discussing it, and showing how it can be overcome. So I think it's an exciting book. It's designed to be read by people who are readers and are serious about this country, its future, its role in the world.
Yes, I think you have written the most exciting and important book of the generation, Unstoppable, and I hope all our listeners will read it. You have been a leading activist since the 1960s, and there were some left-right coalitions then. What's the biggest success you have had personally with a left-right coalition?
Well, I think it's been numerous successes. We stopped things like the Clinch River Breeder Reactor in 1983 that General Electric, Westinghouse, Ronald Reagan, and Senator Howard Baker from Tennessee, that's where the plant was going to be. It was a huge boondoggle. It was a stunning upset, 56-40, in the Senate because of a left-right coalition in Washington. We should remember that the auto safety law passed almost unanimously in the Congress in 1966, and that certainly dismantled the power of the auto companies to decide what level of hazard or safety you were going to have to buy when you purchased a car. The 1986 False Claims Act, that's returned tens of billions of dollars from fraudulent contracting with the federal government to the taxpayer. And that was a left-right as well. That was between Senator Grassley, Republican of Iowa, and Congressman Howard Berman, Democrat from California. They got together and they beat the corporate lobbies. This last year, there was a left-right upsurge in defiance of their leadership in the House of Representatives. They defied John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi. just missed by 12 votes banning NSA dragnet snooping on all Americans. And they blocked, the left-right alliance did block the plunge to war in Syria last year. That's up for renewal, obviously. So I think you see it happening in not just in legislatures. You see it happening in the kind of cultural revulsion to the exploitation of children by corporations, junk food, junk drink, obesity, diabetes, just sweeping aside parental authority, direct marketing to 8, 7, 6, 5-year-olds. I think that's a big one that's coming up. There is a left-right alliance in the courtrooms to have more ballot access for third-party candidates. For example, the Libertarian Party and the Green Party have teamed up, not just in the courtroom, but to also lobby state legislatures to loosen up a bit and let the voters get more choices and more issues and more agenda instead of just being confronted with increasingly similar Democrat and Republican parties dialing for the same commercial dollars. I think there's a left-right alliance going back years for the initiative referendum recall type of government at the state level. And, of course, the opposition to the big banks that are too big to fail and the desire to break them up, that comes in about 90% in the polls, as well as prosecuting Wall Street crooks who got away with it in 2008.
Right. So you've mentioned, you know, some of the emerging left-right coalitions there. Where do you see the biggest energy? Do you think, is it kind of geographically some area in the country? Is it local? Is it national? Or where's the biggest energy coming from for the left-right alliance to dismantle the corporate state?
It's scattered, actually. I can't locate it. For example, the Koch brothers are lobbying southern legislators to put a surcharge tax on solar panels, because now solar panels are being applied to roofs everywhere, and they're challenging the Koch brothers' gas and oil interests. Well, they're not winning, and that's because, you know, you have Republicans and Democrats say, what? I mean, you know, we want solar panels. We don't want them burdened by taxation. the way the oil and gas industry has been coddled by the federal government with all kinds of tax breaks and loopholes and subsidies. So there it is, right in the conservative South. So it depends on the issue. I do want to see it go really big time, because I don't see any other political realignment likely emerging in the next 12 years that actually gets things done for the American people, other than a left-right alliance. So I'll take it wherever it comes up. But I do urge some enlightened billionaires to begin funding citizen advocacy groups that only focus on convergent issues. That is, they don't have any other agenda. They're not fighting left-right. They only go to work every day to push this left-right alliance to dismantle the corporate state, project by project.
Right. I think you put your finger on the key challenge in our country right now, because no matter what issue you might be concerned about, whether it's wanting more renewable energy and less of the fossil fuels, or, you know, changes in health care, or whatever it is you're looking for, the influence of the corporations is so profound in Washington, D.C. that it's distorting every area of policy. So we must address this, and you're so right that left and right see it. It's just, as you say in your book rightly, there's no one who that's what their job is, to focus on building these left-right coalitions. So you call for creating several institutions, but basically having an institutional base for this kind of convergence work, that with an organization or organizations that would have staying power. Have you had much response to that critical idea, and are you working with any group to found such an institution?
Well, we're looking for some rich people to fund it. Foundations aren't likely to. They don't like this issue. They're usually, you know, they're usually either left or right. Foundations are liberal and conservative. So we're looking for individually wealthy people who have a sense that their country's going the wrong way, and that they're not going to hand it in very good shape to their children and grandchildren. So there's a tiny percent of the many billionaires that are around these days. especially as they grow older and, you know, have a different take on what they want to leave behind other than a pile of gold. That's what we're looking for. And it doesn't take that much. I mean, when you see what the Koch brothers have funded in terms of think tanks, or Mr. Skay for the Mellon interests, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, it really doesn't take that much. So if anybody has any leads, we're all ears. But it's going to go on anyway. I think the most exciting on the ground is the support for community-rooted businesses, credit unions, community banks, farmer-to-consumer markets, local renewable energy, community health clinics that focus on prevention. Every time we spend our money, our consumer dollars, with these entities, we're taking away money from Bank of America, Pfizer, big hospital chains, agribusiness. That's called the displacement movement, and that really is conservative liberal. I mean, you don't find conservatives refusing to go to farmer markets because they want to patronize some giant supermarket chain.
Right, and that leads right into my next question: is what about our listeners? You know, what can we do? You know, we're feeling kind of overwhelmed by the power of these corporations, the Koch brothers, the billions that are being spent to, you know, advance the interests of the corporations over the people, in spite of broad support among the people for various policies and so forth. We keep losing in Washington, so. What are the top things that are, like, the top three things that our listeners could do to deal with this whole thing and support the left-right alliance to dismantle the corporate state?
Well, one, you can get a victory next year, because when President Obama sends the Pacific Trade Agreement to Congress, I think right now we have a majority in the House to block it of left-right, in defiance, by the way, of John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi, their leaders. However, you know, the lobbyists will try to spin off some of these. So if you want to tie what I'm going to recommend now to a victory, to begin the first rollback of these corporate-managed globalized trade agreements that have sucked so many jobs and industries out of our country to dictatorial regimes abroad, what you can do is find someone who is opposite you. You know, if you're Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, find your opposite and print a letterhead. You can give it a nice title. You can say the Left-Right Alliance in the 21st Congressional District of New York, and then send and then get a few people also on the letterhead, and then send the first letter to your representative and your two senators. And you can use some of the arguments in this book. You can pick the issues, and then you start increasing your civic skills and how to write a powerful letter and how to bring it to the attention of the member when they come back into your area for trying to ask for your vote. So it's like a little club. It's a lot of fun. You'll meet people you haven't met before. You might help each other get more enlightened on your issues, and you will see the magic of a left-right confrontation with your member of Congress. They really turn pale when they see a left-right coming in at them, because they can't manipulate left against right or right against left, because they can't go the easy way, because they're in a red state. You know, they just pander to the right, or in a blue state to the left, and get campaign contributions accordingly. It sort of perplexes them. I've seen that happen on Capitol Hill. When a staffer says to a senator in the morning, we're getting a huge number of emails, and the senator says, from our supporters, eh? And the staffer says, no, it's coming in left, right. You can't believe the impact. So everything starts with a couple people. Everything starts with a conversation. And now you can start with a letterhead and actually focus it on blocking the Pacific Trade Agreement, because you can get all the information you need by going to globaltradewatch.org, globaltradewatch.org. That's one of our groups, and it lays out all the issues, the arguments. You have a lot of fun. It's fun to build power. It's not fun to have to swallow your grievances and go through life feeling that you don't matter and you don't count. Start the letterhead group.
That sounds great. And then in terms of establishing an institution that focuses on convergence with left and right on this set of issues, you mention in the book that we would start that by maybe spinning off staff and resources from an existing organization and create a new organization where convergence is the only mission. Do you know any specific organizations that you think would be kind of a starting point for that kind of a spinoff?
Yeah, I think ours would offer, you know, the idea is to get like 10 organizations donating one full-time person around a explicit converging agenda so they know what they're getting into. And that's possible. You know, Heritage is quite wealthy, Cato, Public Citizen, I could put one in. There'd be others, people for the American Way. And let's say they all decide they're going to work on five issues, like civil liberties, like corporate welfare and bailouts, like prison reform, maybe anti-war, whatever they all agree on. And that will get it underway.
I think that sounds great. And have any of those conversations started to happen among those organizations?
Well, I've gone over to Cato for a very good session. It was very successful. I want to do it in Heritage before I put the question to them. I've asked Grover Norquist. He could do it. He says he's going to think about it because I was with him at a National Press Club function a few days ago that was relayed on radio around the country. Mm-hmm. So I think it might happen. Remember, these are the groups that have other priorities that are funded that animate them day by day, and they're mm-hmm. usually the priorities of conflict, that is, against one another, not the priorities of convergence. For example, the priorities of conflict would be Heritage and Cato would be against regulating further the coal industry or the nuclear industry, and the liberal side would be for it. So you see, that's the only thing restraining them. It isn't lack of money. So we'll try it. That's why I'm looking for an independent-minded, enlightened billionaire or two.
Right. Well, if we had one, it would get us going. And you write in the book a letter to a billionaire saying exactly what you want to do and where the money would go. So the hunt is on. Is there any other way you see it being funded besides the, you know, a billionaire, or maybe start with some more modest funding and hopefully attract a billionaire into the game?
It could start with just two people. Each side donates one funds for a full-time staff and start with two people.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things they all agree on is that the Pentagon budget is unauditable. Every year, the Government Accountability Office of the U.S. Congress, which is the auditing office of government agencies in the executive branch, has to report that the Pentagon does not provide them with the data that would allow them to be audited. And the Pentagon admits this. They don't even know how these dollars are being spent with any precision. So every few years, the Pentagon says, we'll do it. The latest postponement is 2017. We'll get it by 2017. Well, that probably comes in close to 100% left-right. I mean, half of the federal discretionary budget, apart from Medicare and Medicaid, but half of all the departments and agencies' budget is Pentagon. And there's no major enemy. There's no Soviet Union, you know, that requires heavy-duty systems of weapon destruction and all. And so I think that would really come in. I like that one. And, of course, when you do that, you discover all kinds of waste and corruption, and you can strain tens of billions of dollars out of this $800 billion monster to apply to repairing America at communities all over the country, creating good-paying jobs that can't be exported.
And just so our listeners know, in your book, Unstoppable, you actually name 25 specific areas that the left and right could work on together. And you've mentioned several of them here. Auditing the Pentagon would be a huge one. Getting tough on the corporate crime, you know, checking out just where are all these corporate bonanza bailouts and subsidies and tax breaks, kind of what are they, and stop it. So there's Roster, you've kind of laid out the agenda. That's a good starting point. If we get some folks together, have the conversation across left, right, and just let's pick, you know, one, two, or three of those to start working on.
Yes, I think another big one is giving investors more power over the company executives whose company they own. I mean, the people who own these giant corporations have no power over the people who run them, whose huge bonuses and salaries they're forced to pay. So people left, right are really angry about these gigantic executive salaries that they're giving to themselves with their rubber stamp board of directors. That's a good one for convergence.
Right. And of the issues that you map out there, you're looking at things that have maybe 60, 70, 80%, maybe more of Americans would support that program. So
yeah, that's
it's
right.
It's amazing that we live in a so-called democracy, but issues that have that much support are not moving through Congress, or if they are, they're going in an opposite direction.
Yeah, that's the strategy of the ruling powers, of the plutocracy or oligarch. They want to divide and rule. There's nothing new about that. It's been going on for over 2,000 years. The way you deal with the people is to divide them and pit them against one another on issues they really disagree about, and not at all focus on the very important issues that they do agree about. So left-right disagrees on reproductive rights, gun control, constitutionally required balanced budget, school prayer. We know all that.
Mm-hmm.
And the powers love to focus on that. They know what happens when the people throw off the chains and say, we're going to focus on right down on Main Street and take on Wall Street. And we're going to focus on things that we agree on that can make a better life for everyone. We're up against another convergence, the convergence of the corporate Democrats represented by the Clintons, who are corporatists and militarists, Hillary the Hawk, and the corporate Republicans John Boehner and Senator McConnell and Senator Graham and so forth. They all work together. They push through crony capitalism. They push through wars of empire. They push through tax breaks for the giant corporations and their super wealthy patrons. So that's what we have to break apart. But, you know, they have a lot of money and power, but we have the votes. The left-right alliance has the votes. It's just it has to go operational around redirections for our country.
Right, absolutely. And you mentioned Grover Norquist. I'm curious what he thinks of Unstoppable.
He likes it. He gave a blurb for the back of the book. And I'm going to start with him. I think he's a likely person, and he's got a lot of baggage, of course. He's against unions, and he's against taxes on corporations and individuals. On the other hand, he's against empire, and he's against corporate welfare or crony capitalism, and he's very strong on civil liberties. So, I mean, those are pretty good starts, I must say. And I don't think he likes the Federal Reserve running amok either. So those are good starts.
Fantastic. Well, I so appreciate what you're doing, and your book really is kind of a blueprint and lays out, you know we've got corporate government convergence in favor of the corporations. We can confront that and change that with a convergence among left and right on issues and approaches that can help the majority of the American people and help our country move forward. So
thank you so much. If they want an autographed copy, they can just go to nader.org. And see how you can get an autographed copy of the book if you want to give it to a student or a relative as a gift. Anything to get discussions going. Everything starts with conversation.
Absolutely. I encourage all our listeners to get the book, Unstoppable. Read it. Get a group together in your neighborhood. Get your friends together. Read it and talk about it and see what you can do and how you can be part of taking back America.
And you can sign up for my free weekly column by going to the same website, nader.org. Thank you.
Fantastic. That's all the time we have. Ralph Nader, thank you so much for coming on All Together Now.
You're welcome. Thank you for your good program and your listeners.
Listeners, stay tuned. We'll be talking more about the left-right convergence to dismantle the corporate state after the break. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine, continuing our conversation about a left-right alliance to dismantle the corporate state. Our next guest, James S. Turner, is a partner in the D.C. law firm of Swenken & Turner, founded in 1973. He was one of the first lawyers working with Ralph Nader and wrote The Chemical Feast, the Nader Report on Food Protection at the FDA. More recently, Jim is the co-author of a book on transpartisan politics titled Voice of the People, The Transpartisan Imperative in American Life. Jim is the board chair of Citizens for Health, advocating for consumer rights to natural healing, and Voice for Hope, a transpartisan organization which informs legislators and regulators about the importance of consumer access to natural healing. Jim Turner, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you, Eleanor. I appreciate being here.
So you have worked with Ralph Nader early in your career, and you've been actively working in politics and government since. What do you think of Nader's new book, Unstoppable?
I think it's it's dynamite. I think it's a really fantastic tour de force into both what can be done here in this country now and what is actually going on politically, not only here, but in all democracies across the world, many non-democracies. We have the emergence of something that is much larger than the partisan political spectrum and deadlock that we see every day in the news. So I think it's a real contribution to moving forward.
Wonderful. And I understand you were listening in on that interview with Ralph Nader. Did you have any comments on that conversation?
I did. I did listen into it, and I have many comments. But first of all, I think it's important to underscore a point that Ralph made several times, and that is this is happening, and it is going to happen. What Ralph is describing is ways of joining it, being part of it, moving it along. And you can look at the political dynamics that are underway in this country, and you'll see these emerging activities. Just the election of the new candidate for governor in Delaware, the fusion activities in Alaska, the movement in Kansas for people who are not inside the total political framework to come together to get rid of the current senator there. The whole business of the way that California now does its defining of legislative and congressional districts. These are all areas where you can see what I call the transpartisan imperative working in the country. It's what Ralph would call a left-right coalition or left-right convergence.
Right, exactly. And your book, Voice of the People, is all about transpartisan politics. So how would you describe transpartisan politics?
Well, the notion of transpartisan, let me make one other point about what Ralph has written and what he was saying that goes to the as a sort of introduction of that answer. There's a part of Ralph's book that is extremely important because it draws on the traditional, what we would call conservative theorists for basic social innovation, for the moving forward in a constructive, highly valued way. There is a very strong argument that the entire Bill of Rights, Declaration of Independence, Constitution, generation was a transpartisan coalition. There were people there from all over what would be called the then political spectrum that came together around the issues that were hot at that time. I would describe transpartisan is that everybody, wherever they find themselves politically, has something to contribute to whatever the issue on the table is, whatever it may be. And Ralph listed a bunch of those. Mm-hmm. But if it's the Federal Reserve, people who consider themselves to be progressive, who consider themselves to be conservatives, liberals, radical in either direction, they all have something to place into the discussion. And the transpartisan dynamic is framed to allow that to be heard. That's the basic underlying premise of the whole American experiment. The reason that we are able to solve problems when we are is because everybody from all over the social framework has something to contribute to that resolution.
That's really interesting. I mean, that's kind of the essence of democracy, right? I mean, I think we have it. We're supposed to have that through our U.S. Congress, particularly the House of Representatives, but that is sorely missing in our political debate right now, which has become all too narrow.
Well, I think that's right, and I think that part of what needs to be looked at, which I think Ralph touches on in his book, and when I worked with Ralph in the late 60s, I believe that activity was a very transpartisan activity. We had people that ranged from the Goldwater right over to the Eugene McCarthy left, people who were for Bobby Kennedy and people who were for Ronald Reagan and Nixon, who were all involved in that Nader event and rolled their sleeves up and worked hard on various kinds of issues, just the way that Ralph's talking about now. And what we have going on now that we're suffering from is that the population is much more aligned about issues than the institutions are able to express. So one of the things we point out in our book, Laurie Chickering and I wrote The Voice of the People, Transpartisan Imperative in American Life. One of the things that we point out there is that looking at polling data over the last 30 years, you don't actually see an on-the-ground split in the American public. What you see is a political split. And what you find out is that the political leadership is split from the large mass of the population. That's one of the points that Ralph is making. When you get 90% of or 80% of the public going in a particular direction on an issue, and the institutions all going in the opposite direction. That's true of issue after issue. And the first transpartisan focus, or the first left-right coalition focus, and Ralph touched on this a little bit when he talked about the electoral rules, is to figure out an agenda for how to make the political process be representative of the people. Every president for the last several have had a great deal of trouble actually governing. It's been very difficult to govern. A part of that reason, if we just to look at President Obama, part of the reason for that is that while President Obama won the election, if you look at the constitutionally eligible voters in this country, only 27% voted for Obama. So we have a system that rests upon the notion that somebody will be chosen by the public to represent their point of view. And in this instance, for example, we have something less than a third of the people actually voting for the person in office.
You're talking about such a low percentage because you're including the people who didn't bother to show up and vote.
Not only show up and vote, but didn't register.
Okay.
And they tend to be dropped from the fact that lots of people don't register tends to be dropped from the from the statistics. And we fool ourselves. And then what happens also is you get a vote in a state where a very large majority will go for one party, in case of Pennsylvania, the Democrats, and they have a Republican congressional delegation because of the way the districts are organized. The result is that you get institutions that don't represent the views of the people who they are supposed to be acting for. And and you could hear in everything that Ralph said, you could see that people are now coming together to think of ways to get the voice that is beyond the Democrat, Republican, left-right professional political argument, get beyond that to the deeper, more significant arguments, and they are having impact, and I think that's going to increase over time.
Yeah, well, you know, we're supposed to have elections for that, you know, for, we're pointing out you get 70, 80, 90% of the people behind a certain thing, like wanting to make sure that the people in Wall Street who brought the economy to its knees are held responsible and put in jail. You know, not a single one of those cads was put in jail. So we've got that agreement, the alignment on the issues, but it's not being reflected in the votes in the U.S. Congress. But people are supposed to then vote out their representative, but somehow that doesn't seem to happen.
Well, the structure really makes it difficult. There are a very small handful of districts that are called swing districts, people where the party might switch back and forth. Probably fewer. There's certainly fewer than 50 of those. But there are ways that you could electorally shift the incumbents into a weaker position. Right now, incumbents tend to win elections, and people who aren't incumbents don't. And the incumbents tend to reinforce whatever the current policies are. And one of the things that's happening, I mentioned Alaska and Kansas both, they both have situations where two parts of the political framework are joining together against a third. So then, and there's a little fusion ticket going on in Alaska for governor, and there's one in Kansas where the Democrat and an independent have signed up to run against the incumbent Republican senator.
Right. In Kansas, the Democrat wants to be taken off the ballot to give the independent a chance to beat the Republican incumbent.
Yeah, the Democrat, they just ruled that the Democrat, the court just upheld his going off of the ballot.
Okay,
now,
good.
Now that's an example of what I'm talking about as transpartisan. That's a situation which the partisan issue is less important than the larger political issue of the people who are involved. Now, part of the issue that's involved here is that all campaigns actually have at least three parts, the three choices. Let's just say Republican, Democrat, and other. The other being, I'm not going to vote, for example. And when you decide not to vote, that's actually making a political statement. And that political statement is one that is not charted very well. People don't actually understand exactly why non-voters don't vote. My experience is a very significant number of them, enough to change the outcome of an election, actually are making a political statement that they do not feel that their point of view is being represented. Lots of people don't vote just because they're not there. They just aren't. They've already dropped out of politics. But there are a lot of people who are very passionate about politics who do not see their role or their viewpoint or their interests being represented by the two parties that are running. And so they choose not to participate. Unfortunately, there are so many structures prohibiting third-party effectiveness in our culture that there's really not an opportune moment at this time to create a third party. That was another issue that Ralph underlined as a left-right coalition issue with the Libertarians and the Green Party working to change the third-party ballot rules so that you can have more parties involved. But again, there's not very much structural ability to express yourself politically, but mm-hmm. there is a lot of opportunity to affect the outcome of these issues.
So explain for our listeners, how is transpartisan different than bipartisan?
Well,
you're not just talking about Democrats and Republicans working together on common ground.
That's exactly right. And in fact, I would argue, based on, you know, just taking what Ralph was saying during the during his interview with you, the things that you see that he is calling like the empire-building bias of, say, the Clinton corporate Democrats and the Republican Lindsey Graham-type Republican empire builders, that's bipartisan. That's, as Grover Norquist puts it, it's, you know, Republicans pick your pocket, Democrats pick your pocket, and they get together in a bipartisan way, and they both pick your pocket. That's bipartisan. transpartisan says, wait a minute, everybody involved in this debate, whoever it is, has something to contribute. Let's figure out what would be the outcome if they did that. Now, when you take, and Ralph identified some issues that he thought were pretty intractable, like the abortion question. But in fact, even that is politicized so that the fundamental underlying premise of the culture is pretty agreed, and that is that only about less than 25% of the population supports either abortion on demand or no abortions ever. There is a very strong, probably 60 to 70% population agreement that fewer abortions is a good idea, and a good way to get there is by letting people make good choices and making sure they understand how to make them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is everybody contributing to the outcome, not just one side. And it's not just getting the people who are vociferous to sit down and agree. It's getting not only the vociferous, but the people who are affected by their debate to be involved in the discussion. That's what transpartisan is. An awful lot of people are dropping out of politics because it's being conducted in such a vicious, unpleasant way. And so they're saying, forget it, I'm going to go do something else. Now, frankly, from my point of view, Ralph identified, for example, the whole area of farmers markets. I think that the farmers markets have a very strong commercial food preference presentation to make, and I believe it's also a political statement. It's a statement for local control of the food supply. Ralph talked about the rooftop revolution with solar panels, which is sweeping the industrial world. That is local control over your own energy supply. In the whole area that I work in, and Ralph mentioned this as well, that's the healthcare area, we have well over half of the population using one or more of the natural healing modalities, like massage, acupuncture, chiropractic, and so forth. Those are the ones that are not radiation surgery or chemotherapy. They use them as supplements, they use them as alternatives, but the point is that they're out there taking control of their own personal health care. Now, that coalition, by the way, was very, very strongly involved in that impulse in the Affordable Care Act debate on both sides, I'll mention. But in any case, I'm saying that going across the country, you see all kinds of what would be outside the electoral politics world, all kinds of initiatives that are going on that are actually affecting the electoral world in one way or another. And I believe, as Ralph said in that interview, this is going to continue to snowball. And more people are going to be demanding more and more control over their own lives, and that's going to affect politicians more and more. We're taking people in with Voice for Hope. We're going up to Congress several times a year and presenting natural healing advocates to members of Congress and having a very positive reception when saying that, you know, if we were to use all of these things effectively, we could probably cut our health care bill in half and have better outcomes health-wise. And we're getting a very good hearing on that. It's going to affect the politics over time.
So this Voice for Hope organization that you're the chair of, it's basically kind of bringing together people from across the spectrum, you know, left, right, dropped out, whatever, but all united around natural healing modalities. Is that
correct?
Right?
Yes, actually, just to put just the a little slightly different spin on it, what we're bringing together is people who are committed to advancing natural healing components of the healthcare system, and they turn out to come from all over the political arena, from all over, from the left, the right, the middle. We have people who are very strongly conservative, people who are very strongly liberal, people who are not liberal or conservative, but are what would be called independent or center or whatever the appellation is at that given point. All of them are showing up and participating, and it happens mostly because they've had a personal experience that tells them this is important, and we want it to be included in our healthcare policy.
So,
that's what I think is happening with most of these issues.
Yeah, exactly. So you have a personal experience, and you realize that, you know, the mainstream medical model isn't servicing what you need to heal, or it's an approach or a cost that is beyond what you want to deal with. But there's all these other modalities out there that have been around, some of them thousands of years, like acupuncture, that might be helpful. So was this Voice for Hope group organized while the Obamacare debate was happening?
Yes, it actually was. It's actually Voice for Hope. Hope stands for Healers of Planet Earth. And it was put together by some energy healers who then reached out to all the other various alternative modalities. There are over 100 different organized professional groups that have structures. They have certifications, they have training, they have education, they have degrees. And these are groups that do not use drugs, radiation, or surgery in their approach. And by the way, many of them use them, like acupuncture, are used in conjunction with chemotherapy. Uh-huh. One of the real values of acupuncture is that it makes chemotherapy easier to use. But the point is that the individual has the right to make this broader set of choices. And then think about the farmer's market. Those are people who are going to the farmer's market because they're finding things there at a price and in a quality that they don't find in location, that they don't find in their local supermarket. Or if you take the solar energy people, solar rooftop people.
Well, let's stay with the health for a minute here on the Voice for Hope.
Sure.
So what
sure.
was the effect? Like, I don't even know. What does Obamacare say about, does it cover acupuncture and some of these other modalities?
Well, the premise of the Affordable Care Act is that this is going to be a market-driven framework. From a policy point of view, it has a what's called the Prevention Council, which actually is designed to be it is set up by statute to be all the major cabinet members. I think there are 12 of the cabinet are the members of the prevention. It's basically a health prevention disease prevention health promotion committee that does an assessment of the preventive side of the healthcare policy world. Now, there are many places inside the Affordable Care Act where you can advocate for various alternatives, including all of the natural alternatives I've talked about. And there are many, for example, insurance companies across the country that provide support for acupuncture. Those companies are go right into the pool, and you can choose that pool. Now, from my perspective, it's a cumbersome and less responsive than I would prefer, but it is moving in a direction that is opening up the access to these modalities in the society. There was one member of the drafting group of the Affordable Care Act who was a Michigan law professor who was very knowledgeable about healthcare. Had been involved in the Hillary Clinton battle in the early 90s, and she was assigned the job of working on getting the complementary alternative medicine modalities addressed by the law, and worked very diligently to create opportunities. Now, at the same time, you have to understand it was a very, very heavily lobbied by all of the interests in the current medical system, and we refer to it as being more a health financing reform act than a health reform act. It addressed more how you finance health than how you provide health. But there were these little opportunities that were opened up to move these other modalities into the policy framework.
That's fascinating. And so with Voice for Hope, we now have a living demonstration of what you call the transpartisan politics. We get the left, the right, the independent, the unaligned come together around saying, we know these healing modalities have helped us, and we want to make access to them, make them more accessible to more people, more affordable to more people. It should be included within the framework of our medical care system.
That's what we're doing, and I want to join with Ralph on one other thing, and that is I hope there's a billionaire out there who is listening who will say, I want to support that, because it's very, very difficult getting funding for these kinds of activities.
Right, exactly. Well, if we can get that institution that Ralph was talking about, then we have a place to go to start building on that. And we need to wrap now, but I want to thank you so much for being on our show.
Well, thank you, Eleanor. I appreciate it, and I really also appreciate the Nader interview. I think it's a great service to get this information out to your public.
Thank you so much. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back in 2 weeks from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.